Hello everyone and welcome to Edinburgh West. We have our meetings every month. We're a wee bit later this month because we wanted to accommodate our excellent speaker. This is Stuart McHardy and he teaches Scottish history, maybe as you've never heard about it before. So Stuart's going to give us a wee talk. We're going to have a question and answer session, and then we've got a few announcements to make at the end. There'll be an opportunity to buy Stuart's books as well at the end. So, with no further ado, take the floor, sir.
Okay, right, thanks. I'll stand up because I'm going to wander a bit, but I'll try and keep within Jerry's range. As I say, first thing I've got to say is, I bring fraternal greetings from, yes, Musselburgh. We're doing all kinds of good things down there, and the great thing I was just saying is that every month our numbers are going up, which this long into what is a campaign that nobody counts how long it's going to be is actually quite fantastic. So there's reasons to be a bit cheerful. What I'm going to talk about tonight is basically Scottish history and how what we've been dealt with Scottish history is, I've been looking for a good Scots word, but 95% of it is keech. We have been told so much for so long that it's just no the case. And I've been teaching effectively radical Scottish history for the outreach department at Edinburgh University for the past 26, 27 years. And in that time, I've come to realise that, in one sense, history is always political. And in the other sense, there is an advantage to history for those of us who are, like all of us here, dedicated to the notion of Scotland going back to being what it was, which was its own nation. I'm not even happy with the word independence, because the word independence has been sullied so much because of the arrangement that we were forced into with our neighbours to the south. What's the name of that place again? I keep forgetting. It's like Mordor, particularly at the moment. In fact, have you seen a bigger bunch of orcs than they're currently in the cabinet? I mean, good God almighty. I mean, they're wise. And in Scotland, we've had a problem for an awfully long time. And that is that what we've been given as our history, if you got it at all, was history that was skewed and twisted and designed to make you think that Scotland was getting a great deal out of being in an arrangement with England. And it's only since the institution of the Curriculum for Excellence that Scottish history is officially part of the curriculum. Now tell that to folk from Europe and they look at you in utter disbelief. What do you mean? I mean, I got a lot of good Scottish history at school because my teacher was interested. But there was no obligation to that. And an awful lot of folk I've met, all they ever heard of was Robert the Bruce and William Wallace, and that was it. Maybe Mary, Queen of Scots. You know? And that was it. Now, it's part of the curriculum. It is rooted. It's in there. It's secure. But the problem is the stuff they're teaching is no right. And history, if you think about history in general, the biggest problem about history is simply, where's the women? Women didn't exist in history because history is about big men doing big things. And that's it. And who writes it? Men who want to be big men doing big things. It's a con. This is across the world. It's not just here. It's just that it's particularly pernicious in Scotland. That this notion that it's all about men and kings. God help us, kings, you know. What use are they to anybody? And because of this bias, there are things that a lot of folk know about in Scotland, but are not generally known about. And one of the things that I eventually got so brassed off with all that, I've written three books in the past couple of years. First one, Scotland's Future History. The idea of this was, we'll have to look at what we're going to teach the Bairns now that we're teaching them history, because what we've taught them up to now just simply doesn't fit. I mean, it doesn't. And it goes back, this is not just about England, this goes back a hell of a long way. Because one of the big things, and in the book I just took a few periods because there is a lot of history to write about if you want, you know, and you've got to keep it under control. But one of the big things that has happened in Scotland recently that changes everything, I mean, this is not just for us, not just for the English, this changes everything, is actually something that happened 5,500 years ago. And that was the discoveries they're making up at the Ness of Brodgar in Orkney. They have found what was, in 3000 BC, the biggest stone building on the planet. It's also got to the stage now, because of what the work that's been up, done up there over the past 10 years by Nick Card and the rest of them, that the guys at Stonehenge, which is of course the most important megalithic structure on the planet, they now admit that Stonehenge could only have been built under the influence of what had been happening in Orkney. We know this because there's been pottery found down there and all this. Now, it maybe didn't all kick off in Orkney because there's earlier stuff in Brittany. But what it does show us is that even 5,000 years ago, we weren't at the edges of things. We were at the centre of things. Because when they brought down that big building I was telling you about, around about 3000 BC, they had a feast. And we're caring about this because the cattle bones were all put into the ditch that goes around the site. And the cattle bones all come from the same time. And they calculated many people that number of cattle would have fed. 10,000. 10,000 folk gathering up in Orkney 5,000 years ago. It gives you a different perspective on how the world works when you begin to realise that. And when you tie into that, and there's a good trick, next time you look at a map of Europe, turn it on its side and look at where Scotland is. We're on the other side of what is an open, big open sea lock. England isn't between us and the continent. The map tells you it is, but it isn't. And there's certain times of year when our ancestors, back even the 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, and right up till recently, when folk would sail back and forth over to Denmark and to Norway and down to the Netherlands, because at certain times of the year, that's dead easy. And they knew that they had cousins over there because that's where we'd initially come from. We're part of a much, much bigger European picture, which has all been effectively hidden away because of the xenophobia of English posh boys who control the parliament and the education system down there. And they are xenophobic and they are the most ignorant people on the planet because they believe that if they didn't know it, it is by definition not worth knowing. That is what's at the heart of all this nonsense we're going through at the moment with Brexit. And in trying to come in, it's almost like I'm trying to come up with a different narrative, right? And the narrative that I'm concerned with is the thing that's driven me ever since I was a laddie. I want to ken where I'm fae. Same as if an Inuit in the north of Canada wanted to do that, that would be fine. Or somebody in South Africa, or somebody in South America. Everybody in the world wants to ken where they come from. We are told there's something wrong with it if we do that. Because we have this other narrative. We have this narrative, and that narrative is Great Britain. The most rapacious empire ever on the planet this far. It's not to say there'll not be worse further down the road. But trying to find this other narrative has led me into checking things out, right? And the one thing that I suppose got me, still does, whenever I hear anybody talk about the Scottish Wars of Independence, I spit. What Wars of Independence? When was Scotland ever part of England? Ask yourselves. But what does story tell you? The story that they give, the narrative that emanates from down there, is that Scotland was taken over by the same posh Normans as had taken over England. And then we became, because they were all pally with each other, effectively, we just kind of merged in with them, and since then we've become the same place. And the story is that we are the same. No. We're no. And our history absolutely shows it, and there are various things. I mean, I've only got a wee while here, and I'm trying to condense 20 hours into 45 to 50 minutes. It's difficult. Bear with me. But there's major differences between us and England that affect how we see the past. First one, the bloody Romans. Right? The Romans are awfully important to the English, and not just because they developed their own empire, with our help, but because England was part of the Roman Empire for 400 years. Up here, the Romans came, they saw, they got gobbed, they buggered off. The longest period they were ever here was 20 years, broken in the middle, and that was on the Antonine Wall, and during that period, it was exactly the same as the British and the Americans in Afghanistan. They never went outside of their forts unless they were tooled up. There are no Roman settlements in Scotland. No, even south of the Antonine Wall. We've got about four villas, and they are right jam-packed, right up against the side of forts, over in Mulgay, and there's one at Cramond. But we're given this story. I mean, the thing I like is, you know, that you talk to folk, particularly people of a certain age and background, and oh, of course, the Romans, you know, they gave us straight roads. Myers! Do you ever know any human being that wouldn't have put on a straight road if they could? But think about that. You would tell that the Romans gave us straight roads. I mean, it's utter and complete bloody nonsense. But it comes out of this attachment to the Romans that the Brits have got. The other thing, of course, was that they gave us plumbing. Who has been to Scarabray? Scarabray's got plumbing. Indoor plumbing. Oh no, it was the Romans that gave you that. Bloody savages. And it got so bad. I mean, I've done an awful lot in Pictish studies over the years. Written books on Pictish history and all the rest of it. And I keep on giving this quote from a professor. I think he was at Oxford. And he's talking about, I can't in mind which are the Carausius. One of the Roman generals was over here, and he'd come up one summer. This would be, I think, somewhere in the 2nd century. He came up during the summer and, you know, went back. And this is a professor writing the textbook. And I quote, "And he must have had a great victory over the Picts." What? He must have had a great victory over the Picts. Why must he have? Because they were Romans. And that was just a bunch of bloody jocks up there. Because that's the other thing that's in all of this. Utter and complete contempt for us as a people and as a culture is part of the narrative that we've been given. And this notion that's come up even about the Picts, I mean, that they're enigmatic, they're strange, they're weird people. You know, did anybody see the utter nonsense that was in the Scotsman the other day? I mean, unmitigated nonsense. If a 12-year-old had cobbled that together for the net, the teacher would have sent them home. And this was in the Scotsman just the other day, because people can still mess with our history. And just in passing, I should tell you that the propaganda that has caused us problems doesn't just come from south of the border. Most of you will have heard that the Scots came from Ireland. They bloody didn't. There is no evidence whatsoever. The Scots were also in Ireland, but they kind of lived, there were a sea people that lived on the sides of both islands, effectively. But the Scots didn't come in. That was Christian propaganda to big up Columba. You know, the dove of peace. A man who we have got on record as being, you know, a thief and a warmonger. But oh no, he was the dove of peace. So to big him up, the Scots had to come for him. Seriously, it's all in the book. It's on the book. But to get back to what started me here, the Wars of Independence. The idea that we were fighting a war of independence. Did the French fight a war of independence against the Germans in the Second World War? Would anybody ever think to tell them that they did? They would, as my granny would have said. They'd scalp you in the bus if you said that to them. But we're told that it was a war of independence to get people thinking that naturally we should be part of the English state, not the British state. British state is what they've called it since they managed to con us. But it is to get you into thinking it's a natural thing for us to be part of that. It bloody isn't, because we never were. Because they had the Romans. We were never part of the Roman Empire. We were still running about, you know, doing what we did. which did involve quite a lot of intertribal rivalry and fighting and raiding and all that kind of stuff. But that's the same across the planet. We weren't any different. They were maybe different, but we weren't. We were the same as everybody else. And the other thing that we'll have to, just to put the background in before, there's a couple of things I really do want to tell you about. But the other thing that is important is the feudalism thing. Right? Now, people will tell you, oh yes, all the lairds are descended from the French. Right? Well, my name's McHardy and I've got a French genealogy. And I'll give it you just to show you how preposterous it is. It was in the time of David I before he came to the throne, late 12th century. He was a hostage in England under one of the Edwards or Henrys or whatever they were. I can't tell one from the other. And at the same time, the Dauphin, the heir to the French throne, was there. And one day they're brought in to meet the English king, and the English king says to his cupbearer, his wine bearer, he says, pour me a glass of wine. Okay, that's not fine, you know. Probably claret. And he says, give it to the most honourable of my guests. Now that's typical of a king. That is real nasty. In fact, that's a shitey thing to do to anybody. It really is. And the guy swithered and all the rest of it, and then he hands it towards David the First. At which point, a Frenchman, acting like he came from Dundee, stepped forward and knocked the glass out of his hand at the insult to his prince. At which point, the Dauphin of France says, tout tard, dis mon brave! Didn't be so rash, effectively. And quick as a flash, David the First, who of course spoke French himself, says, il sera désormais Hardy. From now on, he will be called Hardy. And so his children became known as McHardy. Utter and complete tendentious rubbish. And part of a process by which the Scottish lairds have tried to make themselves as much like the English aristos as they possibly can. Pretend to be like them. I can even give you a very good argument that shows that Robert the Bruce wasn't descended from any Norman. He was direct Viking descent. And if you really doubt this, we're in certain ways, although our history has been buggered about so much, we have got a whole load of fabulous advantages when we're looking at the past. And one of the things that constantly inspires me is the 1320 letter to the Pope, the Declaration of Arbroath. Now, apart from the fact it does something that nothing ever before in the world was known like and has been the basis for the creation of modern human rights, in actual fact, the statement in there is that the assembled noteworthy people, let's cry them that, claim to be speaking on behalf of the entire population, and then they say, and it's nothing about 100 of us will fight against the English, that's not the important thing. What they say is, if good King Robert will not keep out the English, we will make ourselves another king. Think about that. If good King Robert will not keep the English out, we will make ourselves another king. And they're claiming to be speaking on behalf of everybody. And what that is an echo back to actual tribal law. It's got nothing to do with feudal law. It's tribal law. And tribalism survived in Scotland into the 18th century, which we'll come back to in a minute. But that, you go through it, and I've been through the document many times, and there's all these names. And people tell me, well, yeah, you can see it there. You know, they're all Normans. De Menteith. De Lennox. I say, what's French for that? Oh, the de. Go through all the names that have got de in them. And the second part, or the bit after the de, is a Scottish place name. There's nothing French about that. That is what you call a convention of writing your name. There is one, William de Umfraville. I've not managed to find that. Somebody said it's probably somewhere down near the Gallagate, but no, I don't believe it. There was William de Umfraville, but other than that, there is no evidence of any feudal class in Scotland. What there was, and still is an awful load of charters handed out by David I, because he loved the notion of feudalism, because it bigged him up. And so he was handing out charters willy-nilly. And they're all written in absolutely perfect feudal language. The only thing is, he's handing them out for places like Argyll and Strathspey and the islands. which remained tribal for more than 600 years afterwards. And we're all supposed to believe that in came these guys, these posh guys, to England, well, to Brittany and Normandy, via England, and they came in and they took over all these tribes, which were composed of people related by blood, every man jack of which had been trained in the use of weapons and trained to use them, and some of the women. There is evidence to suggest there were women warriors among them as well, certainly back a bit. And if you come from Dundee, that wouldn't surprise you at all. You know? No, the wife's not here, am I right? The idea that you could come in and graft people on to a tribal society is absolute and utter bloody nonsense. But it's part of building up this narrative that Scotland is just like England. And the truth of the matter is, it is not at all like England. You think even, I mean, I'm no a great one for doing any studying of kings. I mean, the Stuarts, I think, you know, they should have had an alternative name, the McNumpties. I mean, what a lot they were, you know, for centuries. I hold out no grief for any kind of royalty whatsoever. But at least the kings in Scotland are noted throughout the medieval period by every traveller that comes to Scotland as being unique in Europe. Because not only did they speak the same language as the population, which by this time is Scots, folk could actually speak to them. It was known. And then you had Jimmy IV actually used to dress himself up as a gaberlunzie, as a beggar, and go out to see what everybody was saying in the country. Can you see that anywhere else? Find that in history? No. What you find is that kings and aristocrats are trying to separate themselves away from the people. Here, they're still aware of that fundamental truth that is there in the 1320 Declaration, which is then taken up later by Chalmers and also to some extent by John Knox. And it's out of Scotland that the notion comes that the rulers can only rule with the consent of the ruled. Speak to anybody that's done serious work on human rights and studied it in depth. They all come here to look at the documentation that comes here, because the ideas were here. And we've been allowed to forget that. We've been allowed to let that go. And to me, it's something that, and this is where the Sleekit bit comes in, right? Talking about these things, making people aware of these things, is part of a deliberate policy on my part to give folk ammunition to spread doubt in the minds of no voters. Get them thinking about who they are. Get them thinking about actually what our culture is and what our history is. And they'll be too bloody ashamed to vote no. I maybe know that far. Some of them are hard-necked buggers. I do know that. But it will cast doubt. And I should say at that point that when it comes to history, I wasn't there either. Right? All I've done is read lots and lots of books and think about lots and lots of things and visit lots of sites. And write endlessly about it for years, but I still wasn't there. All I can do is say, I can give you an interpretation of history. There are other interpretations of history. What matters is you making up your own mind about it. Because historians are no to be trusted. Because they all have an agenda. My agenda is simple. I want Scotland to be independent so we can sort out looking at the history. But I at least admit my agenda up front. And I've also had it said to me quite a lot over the years and been attacked for this, even in some quite respectable academic places, for being too left-wing. Right? I'm no left-wing in the least. I used to be. I was brought up in a communist family, and my father's still the biggest communist influence on me, and I mind asking him, what's the basis of you being a communist? He's a communist all his life. Very successful, quite posh chap, actually, my father. God knows how much money he put in to the CP. But he said, communism is basically simple. He said, socialism, he said, is from everyone according to their ability, to everyone according to their ability. But communism is from everyone according to their ability, to everyone according to their need. right? Now, that has always been my basic credo. And the more I studied Scotland, the more I studied what our actual history is, the more that I look into the socioeconomic patterns or how the majority of people lived in Scotland, the more I realised that was at the core of who we are. Because that, believe it or not, is the absolute basis of tribalism. Tribalism gets an awfully bad name in the world because of the empires were going around the world robbing, looting, raping and pillaging amongst people who were essentially tribal. But the whole idea of tribalism is like an extended family. And it existed here right up to the middle of the 18th century. And I would... This is your essay question, right? What's the difference between communism and communitarianism? I'm no communist. I'm a communitarian. I believe in community. I believe in everybody being in together. I even believe Tories should be allowed to vote. I mean, I'm so broad-minded, it's just no true. But we have to, if we're going to understand these things, we'll have to think about it. And the one strand I see all the way through, you think back to the great megalithic structures and, you know, the people that they get to tell you about them on the television. I'll not pretend to be anybody at all. I going on about, you know, the big men. And not so long ago, all these big stone structures were monuments to kings. That's what they thought they were, because it was posh boys that were writing history. You think about it. Every megalithic complex in Scotland is unique, right? There's no two the same, because they all reflect the fact that they were built by the community that lived there. They are localised. They are part of local culture. They have, there's a kind of general overall kind of pattern to them in that they're using bloody big stones and they're all aligned on the sun and the moon. Not the stars, just the sun and the moon. But the fact that they're all localised made me start thinking, these were put up by the community. And if you think about it, I was up in Stornoway a couple of years ago and there was a job of work needing done up in the northwest corner, up Inchway in Lewis. And I was speaking to somebody about it and I said, "No, how'd they do it?" I said, "Oh, well, we just did what we normally do. Everybody got together and did it. It was it was a wall along the road need fixed, or there was going to be a problem, so everybody got together. And for the length of time they were doing it, the guy that had the most experience as the builder was the chief. As soon as we finished for the day, they went to the pub and he was no different again. Folk work together. It's as natural as drawing breath. And it's something that has been taken out from all other histories, not just British history and Scottish history, but history across the whole world. But it's particularly pernicious here, because this notion of the community has been at the heart of what we were about for a very, very long time. And it's in trying to understand that that I selected out what I was going to do. Because I must talk a wee bit about my books and try and screw some money out of you. Come on. I looked at various things. Oh, and by the way, just forgotten that was in there. That is probably the earliest known carving from Scotland. And it's of a wifey at a temple. Who was she? She was a goddess. We have our own mythology in this country. I've not got time to go into that, but I'm writing about that at the moment, and I've made one film about it, and I'm going to do another quite soon, that we had a separate mythological understanding that was ours. Didn't come from Ireland, shared quite a lot with Ireland. Didn't come from Norway, shared quite a lot with Norway, but was ours. And it's been ignored, completely and utterly. In fact, so much so, and this is the best example I know about the problems of education. They've been teaching a thing for the past 40, 50 years called Celtic studies. Right? Now, I hate the word Celtic, and it's no because of my hunt. But I hate the word because it didn't exist before 1700 with any other meaning than northern. And since then, it's had all this stuff piled onto it, and it doesn't really mean anything at all. There are no Celtic people at all. But when they were studying teaching these Celtic studies at the universities. They had three textbooks. They're still being used. Celtic Realms, Pagan Celtic, Britain, and I've forgotten the third one, but there's three of them. And they talked about Celtic-speaking tribal warrior societies. Right? And in the whole three books, Scotland is mentioned five times. They're talking about Celtic tribal warrior societies in Ireland up to the 13th century. They're talking about Celtic tribal warrior societies in Wales through the 13th century. In Scotland, half the country was still occupied by Celtic-speaking tribal warrior societies up until Culloden. And they weren't in the books. And they're still no in the books. Because whatever it was we were up here, it wasn't worth looking at. We have been wiped from history. So much of who we are and what we're about has actually been eradicated. So if I were coming out with degrees in Celtic studies, and didn't he know that the last true Celtic warrior-speaking society was in the Highland clans? And clan just means tribe. So it is, well, actually it means children, which is part of, again, the communitarianism or tribalism, is that you are in debt to your ancestors, and because you're in debt to your ancestors, you are obliged to pass on your knowledge to the coming generations, which is why clan means children, because it's always about the future. We're always taught that tribalism is a crude, pathetic, primitive way of living, and it's no. It certainly doesn't have to be. The one thing it's just no very good at is putting up with capitalism. And we've had all this eradicated from us. And the problem with it, I'll give it another 5 minutes or so. I want to give you a good story. A story about heroes. And one of them's here this evening. Because the other year, I did one of my radical history of Scotland courses in the Yes Hub. 10 weeks, 2 hours ago, and it was great, and it was fabulous. And in the course of it, I said to the folk that were coming along that I'd had problems with a document, right? There is this document called the Cantonment Registers of the British Army, 1746 to 1753. And this is a detailed document enumerating all of the British Army posts in Scotland for the 10 years after Culloden. And I managed to get a photocopy of it. There's one copy exists, and it's in the library of Edinburgh Castle, and they very kindly given me a photocopy of it. But it was a big job to transcribe it, you know, a couple of hundred pages, and I'm tend to be busy. I've got to get to the pub sometime. And I mentioned this to the class, and what they said was, we'll do it. Anne is one of them. And they did it. And then something absolutely marvellous happened. Something really, really marvellous happened. Just so happens that one of the lads in the class is a retired IT professional. So what has he done? He's mapped them. And since then, they've all gone on, and this document only applied to the mainland. Because these folk are so committed, some folks say they should be, but that's just no fair at all. They have gone on and now map the islands as well. Over 500 separate British Army posts in Scotland after Culloden for about 10 years. That is a military occupation of Scotland by the British Army. There is no other interpretation of it. Have you heard of it?
No.
Yes, yeah. No, yeah, since they did, you know. Did you know that before?
I knew about the document from the course.
What, they knew about it in Glasgow? My God, what's the world coming
to? No. Really
good, Dovett Brune. All right.
Class in Scotland.
No, good. Well, now it's out there. Right. Well, what I'd like you all to do, if you want, is to actually get your phones out and type in Stennis Historical Society, because the map is now online. And it's getting added to all the time. Now this is, you would think this is the kind of thing that the media would be all over, because it's so new and so unexpected and all the rest of it. Guess what? Nothing. We have to spread the word amongst ourselves, but the word has already spread, because as I speak, Murray Pittock, professor actually of literature at Glasgow University, he has been writing about the Jacobites a lot over the past few years, and he is bringing out a book, hopefully be out this year or next, actually called The Occupation, which is looking at this. Now, that to me is the perfect example of what the problem is. That document was there sitting in Edinburgh Castle, and nobody thought at all about making the information available. Why would you? Because it goes against the narrative of Britain. Because it tells you that Scotland is Scotland, Scotland. There is no Britain, Scotland. There is no England. So it just gets kept down. And the people that are good at doing that, they don't need to be told. They can themselves know to do it. Because if you, I mean, there's a great thing at the universities that, you know, they try and tell it's about knowledge and all the rest. No, it's not. It's about getting a job. And it always has been amongst the academics. And that particular example, or the map, that the Stennis Historical Society, the heroes of the Stennis Historical Society. Well, no, it's marvellous what you've done, because I couldn't have done it on my own. Never, it would still be languishing in a, you know, the back of a cupboard in my house. But now it's out there, it makes you think, what else is out there? What else do we know about? And one of the things that, for a long time, all of us that do the radical side of things have been talking about is the late 18th century, after Culloden. But we are now at the stage where we can link together anti-unionism, 1707, with the Jacobites directly. We know, and Murray Pittock's going to say this explicitly in his book, that in modern terms, the Jacobites in Scotland were nationalists. The ones in England were different. The ones on the continent were different, but the ones in Ireland were a different kind of nationalist, but they were nationalists and all. But he's actually going to say that. And there is a link that goes through all of that, that comes up into the late 18th century. And just, I'll finish with this at the moment. I'll take questions if folk want. Recently, there's been a fair bit of work done by the Thomas Muir Society. You know, they've done a fair bit of work, but they're falling into the old trap. They're making it about one man. That period was full of absolutely fascinating characters, some of whom are the most glorious bampots you could ever hope to come across in your life. And I'm thinking not just of, Balloon Tyler, the guy, the first balloonist in these islands, who also was part of setting up the Encyclopaedia Britannica. He had to flee the country. But there was another one that left who, if I've got time, I would really like to do a biography of this guy. James Callender Thompson. He was writing stuff in the mid-1790s that were critiques of the British Empire that read like they were written in the 1970s. I kid you not. Forced to leave because he was so radical. There was a lot of them were forced out. After the trials of the martyrs. And he went to America, where he is extremely well-kent, because he is seen as one of the founding fathers of what they call yellow journalism. You know, the smearing and all the rest of it. He was one of the best at that. Unfortunately, he also liked the dram, so he didn't last that long. But I'll just finish with one other, just in passing. Has anybody heard of Fanny Wright? Fanny Wright, father, another radical, forced to leave Scotland in the 1790s. She's brought up in Sooth, comes back up, lives here for a while, goes to America, young woman, has a child out of wedlock, to General Lafayette, the famous Frenchman, goes on to set up a place called Neshoba, which bought slaves, paid them a wage, and as soon as they paid back the money, they were off. Worked with the younger Owen to set up newspapers and all the rest of it, and then started touring America, giving lectures on women's rights and why all religion is not to be trusted. And was known throughout America as the red harlot of socialism. Faye Dundee, and nobody cares. Why? Because, again, she's feeding into a narrative that shows who we are and what we're about. And it's, I believe, not only do we have to get into it, because, you know, I'm an obsessive. And totally wired into the history thing. But like I say, all this material, which you will get in these very, very interesting books, Scotland's Future History, followed up by Scotland's Future Culture, and then The Wife for It, which is just a rant, but it's in Scots, so you can read it to your family, sort of thing. The reason that I put these together was, as I said earlier, to give people material to put doubt. Because if you can get a no voter doubting to the extent they didn't vote, that's as good as another yes vote. Okay.
Thanks very much, Stuart. Now, can we take a few questions from the floor, Mary?
Pass that mic into the floor.
Oh, yes, sure, I'll do that. Right, okay, Mary, I'll bring a mic down to you.
Your comment about if people knew their cultural background, they'd be ashamed to vote no. I heard a professor from Aberdeen, I can't remember his name, recently been interviewed, and he was saying that in 2014 we spent far too much time talking about the economic argument and not enough about the cultural side of things. And it would make sense when you think of, you're always saying, why do people not see it? You know, the money, they take it. They do probably see it, but that doesn't matter so much. So how much do you think we should go economic argument and cultural argument?
I think we should have just some pretty straightforward economic arguments. The most important one being, and thankfully Business for Scotland have been doing a bit on this, it's in this one, I think. I actually give a table, the last complete table I could find that had been done. Is it in this one? If it's not in this one, it's in the other one. And it was the budgets for the first 20 years of the 20th century. The most money ever spent in Scotland, or the money that was taken out, was about 60%. And usually it was below that. We have been net contributors to the British budget since 1707. This is one of the things about the narrative of history, is that I try and tell us, no, you're kept going by the sufferance of the English. Now just think about that for a minute. The posh boys are paying to keep us. How likely is that? And, you know, that's all you got to do is think about that. That's the argument we need to be doing on that. We don't need any more complicated than that. But the cultural argument is awfully important. And I've always worked with, you know, I've worked an awful lot with the language and with music and with history. And, you know, I've done an awful lot all my life. And I've always worked on the cultural side of things. But Hamish Henderson, who first met him as a student, he said to me numerous times, I couldn't always understand it because whiskey always seemed to be involved somewhere. No idea. That was cultural. That's what that was. That was culture. He said, Gramsci got it right. Gramsci, the Italian philosopher. He said, Gramsci got it right. And I said, what are you on about? He says, basically, he says, politics follows culture. It never in the history of mankind has worked the other way around. If your culture is strong, if you can who you are, the politics will follow. The politics can't take you there. You've got to be there and then push the politics. So my attitude is revel in who we are. By saying that I'm so proud of interested in where I come from and who I am. That doesn't mean to say I'm special or better than anybody else, but the one thing it does say is I'm no damn worse than anybody else, and that particularly applies to the posh boy numpties that run government in this country. And it's really just a matter of saying we are as entitled as anybody else. And the argument, this is an argument that's been going on a long time, and basically it was for the Labour Party. The argument, again, it was always, oh no, we've got to stand with our brothers and sisters in solidarity. What brothers and sisters? Do you mean the Irish? Do you mean the Norwegians? Do you mean the Danes? No, we mean the English. What? We are by nature and by history an internationalist nation. We are not xenophobic. Some of us are. We've got our own numpties like anybody else had. But our culture and our history has always been that we are part of a much wider cultural and political area. And we should be reminding ourselves of that constantly and reminding other people of it. You know, and one of the ways of doing that is actually use Burns. Because folk love Burns across the world. I'm still waiting for my invitation to the first Shakespeare supper, by the way. But Burns is a good example of this, because there wasn't a mill, a foundry, or a mine that didn't have one or two real Burns specialists in it. And these were people, there was one that I like to talk about. He was a guy called Patterson, Bill Patterson, from Gosden in Ayrshire. And he got into Burns, and from there he got into poetry in general. And he was kind of in the mind as Big Word Willie with a yard and a half of poetry in his press. And what he illustrated was one of the great things of Scottish culture over the past 200 years. What they used to cry, the autodidact. Because we as a nation have been literate since the Reformation, and that's not true in many places. We have a history of literacy at our core that has meant that people, despite all the class trappings and other bloody nonsense that has come from down south, have gone out and used their own brains to educate themselves. And that is part of that culture as well. And it's something we should all be reminding ourselves. That we don't need handouts for anybody, we can do it ourselves.
Okay. Anyone got any other questions? Sorry.
Hi, this may provoke some amusement, if not ridicule, but we've got this for our son's new BBC Scotland channel. Yeah, I know. But I think it's worth pitching to their programme department a series on an alternative history of Scotland. It may well get knocked back, but at least we're shown that we are there with ideas to participate in the future broadcasting of Scotland. Because as long as this media is an albatross around our neck, we are going to get stuffed time after time after time. So at least it's a pitch. What harm can it do?
Bugger. I worked a lot for the BBC through the 80s and 90s. Wee bit into this century. Did an awful lot of freelance stuff on history and on story and on language. Wrote programmes, presented them, mainly just on as a guest, but and also sat on a couple of groups for the Parliament dealing with the BBC, the cross-party groups. And I got so sick to the back teeth of them. And it wasn't just the bias. It was the bloody ignorance and the damned arrogance of them. And I got really ripped off by them, badly, and got so offended that I actually phoned them up about 6 years ago and said, take my name off every one of your databases, please, I'm having no more to do with you. And I would find it difficult to go back in. But I take your point, which is why I said, bugger. It should be done. Maybe we need somebody younger. Maybe we need somebody with longer hair.
I'm doing that, man.
Well, I'm not really there myself either, you know.
There's one here now.
No, that is, yeah, why not? Bugger.
Well, just.
just to build on that, people are now making really good and rich content themselves. We don't need the BBC. And there's plenty of aspiring filmmakers out there.
Round of applause for Independence Live. Yeah.
And Independence Live has now been joined by a new thing called Unchained Media, which is some people who are in Independence Live as well. Mm-hmm. And they're dedicated to making videos and hopefully programmes reflecting Scottish history and Scottish politics and Scottish interests. So if there's anybody here that would like to make a documentary, why don't we just do it?
Unchained Media, I've not spoken to, but I'd be happy to, because I'm at the planning stages. Gary and I are actually talking about where I'm going to go with this. I have dabbled, and I do have. In fact, I'll be starting serious work on doing a series, just exactly that. I'm going to do 6 45 minutes, because I thought 10 2-hour slots doesn't really work on television, you know. But 6 45 minutes, so I'm going to do a kind of series of talks. Because it doesn't need to be done. But there are other things out there, and we aren't doing it ourselves. The problem is, and it's the same problem as we're finding with the Yes groups in general, that we're all coming along, we're all happy doing things. Everybody's got busy lives anyway, so you don't even want to try and drag people into the mayor all the time. But we need to be talking to each other more than we do. We need to be meeting up. We need to be... There needs to be the equivalent of a kind of club thing, where you know that at certain times of the month there's going to be like-minded folk that you can go and talk to, and it's not going to be an agenda, and it's not going to necessarily lead you into having to get up mayor time, but you're going to talk to folk and you're going to exchange ideas. We need to be doing that more in general. And that problem is very much there in the media, because the BBC have got such a dominant role in Scotland that the majority of folk didn't even know there is community radio. You know, I used to sit on the board of the small broadcasters, and the problem there was trying to get all them to work together, because the funding is difficult. They're all having to rely on volunteers, and volunteers, when they're doing something, particularly in media, no got the time to go out and start organising structures. So we need, that's something that needs to, something needs to be coming up with ideas that will link them together. You know?
Well, we don't need to reinvent the wheel.
No.
Scotland, and it's just a case of encouraging all people now that would like to make content with culture, yeah, to make it and put it on these platforms.
Aye, but there's a problem. And the problem, I mean, I know, because I've done a lot of work with I Write Radio, which some of you may have heard of, which broadcasts out of Leith. The problem we had there, that we could put in a lot of work, do a lot of things, we put on all kinds of different shows and all the rest of it. How do we reach a new audience? How do we get the word out? Because the big boys have got, they're in all the newspapers. People have got habits. Young folk do. Young folk pick and choose. But how do we get into them?
That's Make it tribal. Make it tribal. Each area talks to the community in the area.
I'm all for that. As long as I didn't have to try and add another day into my week. I mean, 9's enough at the moment. Seriously. Yes, you're right, I agree totally. And I'm happy to speak to folk about that any time. And as I say, I've got stuff planned, and I've got some stuff written. I just... Too busy writing books, you know. That's what.
Get some of your students to make programmes.
Another question. It's not quite a question, but as you say that we're talking about Scotland, we're a different nation from England. I mean, we are completely different. Until people stop talking about the country, as in the UK, we're never ever going to be Scottish. And people aren't going to turn to independent, because subliminally, every single person talks about the UK as the country. Our MPs are doing it at Westminster, saying the exact same thing, the country. Mm-hmm. They should say the UK.
Absolutely.
Because the UK is not a country, it's a political union.
Yes.
Britain's an island.
Yep.
There's no Great Britain. I don't know where that comes from. And to me, that's the most infuriating thing I ever hear, is when people talk about the country, as in the UK.
Yeah.
Once we start talking about the country, we're talking about Scotland. If you want to talk about the UK, call it the UK.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were guilty of it yourself. We're all guilty of it.
Yeah.
And our politicians really need to get a hold of this, because once they start talking about Scotland, the nation, no Scotland, not the country as in the UK, isn't it? And they've got to say that. They've got to turn around and say the political union. The UK, because that's what it is.
Yeah,
it's not a country.
You're right, and I think
until people realise that, people don't realise that.
I think you're right, and I think that George Kavanagh got it dead right when he actually said that we've got to start talking about folk in there as Britannats. We've got to start separating ourselves out of it any way we can. And one of the ways, my way of doing that is to emphasise the culture all the time, because this is who we are. And we're defined by our culture. We're partially defined by the fact there is a border between us and them. And I'm looking forward to the day when there's a 40-foot wall and a 30-foot ditch. But that's just my fantasy. I think we have to approach that culturally, because it's awfully difficult to do that politically. And part of the problem there, and it's a problem that at the moment I didn't see a way past it, is the fact that the SNP are far too cautious, because they themselves are part of that same system. They are a Westminster political party. We didn't need a Westminster political party. We need a branch or a Holyrood party down there. And that is a difficult thing to get over. Absolutely. And the people are up here. And I think that I think Blackford did a brilliant job the other month when he walked out. Day more often. You're having shite misses, I'm a what. You know? People say it's just gesture politics, but it emphasises the difference, and we'll have to emphasise the difference any way we can. But my way of doing it is to work with the culture. Because whatever happens, I'm not joining any political party. Because I'm a Marxist, a Groucho Marxist. I'll not join anything that would let me in.
Just going back to the media side again, I was having a chat probably a couple of weeks ago, incidentally at Tannadice, with a guy called Alistair Heather, who has been doing some stuff with him and his pal, whose name I can't remember, making films in various parts of the Northeast. Not on necessarily on independence issues, but he puts a wee bit of independence into the film, and subliminally and so on. One of his latest ones, I think, was The Burning of the Clavey at Birkhead. And what he was proposing to do, although it was over a pint, and chatting about it, was to set up training groups for folk from various places. Initially, it was going to start in the Northeast, and the idea was that these guys would make little films, put them on the local Facebook sites. I suppose in Queen's Ferry it would be the only way, is the ferry and such like. Other places have got their own Facebook pages. And he said the number of hits you get on the, going that way, rather than setting up a completely new channel like Broadcasting Scotland or Independence Live, which perhaps not that many people, apart from the converted watch, might be the way to go.
I think that's true in a way, but that which also leads into another thing, because an awful lot of my teaching has veered towards the political, and I never shy away from it. Which the university didn't always like. Tough. And it's a question, how many trees are for it's a forest? Or a better analogy might be, how many wee trickles coming down the face of the dam before it breaks? So everything matters. The smallest thing matters. The biggest thing matters. Keep doing stuff. Keep talking to people. And this to me, is the most remarkable thing. Now, I've been involved in a lot of stuff in my life. I was one of the vigil for the Scottish Parliament for most of the way through. And it's still the proudest thing I've ever done in my life. And recently, I've been getting the same kind of feeling, not just going around various groups, but also at our group as well, because it has been 3 years. And there's actually more of us now than there was then.
That tells you something. And I would go so far as to say I didn't believe a word that comes out of any Paul, and haven't for years, because they're weighing the questions, and I think they're also weighing their respondents. And what I think they're doing there, because I caught the BBC doing this a few years back, I think what they're doing is they're going back and saying time and time again, because they're getting the answers they want. So we should be thinking more about, that's part of the media. Why trust it? Carry on and do things. And every little thing, yeah, helps and encourage folk. And I'm open to, you know, helping wherever I can. And if people want any help from me, I'll just give you my email anyway, it's dead easy. blokeinabonnet@gmail.com. Couldn't it be easier, you know? Anybody else?
Yes.
Thanks. I'm curious if you have any comments on the future history of local government in Scotland and where it plays into this narrative that we need to change.
It's just over a year since I left Edinburgh, and it moved into Fisher Row and Musselburgh, and it has done my blood pressure a great deal of good, because I'm no screaming at the council every day of my life. I think that the answer, it probably wouldn't go quite as far as this, but I think that the answer to this is what Leslie Rurik's been saying. Her whole idea of following the Norwegian model and get it down, that money is being distributed at basically nearly a street level. That's the way I think we'll have to go. We need to convert the whole of governance in this country, and I think, again, this is one of the problems we'll have, that there's no been enough thought put into this, and there's not been enough leadership on this coming for the SNP. But I do have to say that I think the Greens, and in particular St. Andy Whiteman, is doing absolutely great work. I mean, you know, there's hardly a week goes by when he's not getting his finger right on it, because the answer to virtually all of Scotland's economic problems, such as they are, is just basically to nationalise the land, pay the lairdies, right? Pay for it, market price, pay it back over 100 years. That would be, I think, the land tax, I think, is the first step in the reform of local government. Change the economic basis and then get the, you know. I mean, what's a constituency here? 110,000. It's madness. How can you ever speak to your representative? That's how you can get away with the rich boys doing it. That's why the rich boys all get invited in, because they will speak to the rich boys. There's too many of us for them to speak to, so we drop off the radar. Even the SNP, even the ones that care about these things, because that is the nature of the beast we're fighting. So I think that, yeah, we'll have to reform local government, but get the land tax in, and it would all follow through that, I think. Or make Andy Whiteman Prime Minister.
Well, Andy Whiteman, I remember him explaining that in Norway, the money actually flows up the way. Mm-hmm. Like, you pay your tax to your local government, and then the level above that, and it's only really higher rate tax payers mm-hmm. that contribute. Yeah. So if the money's going up the way, the power's going up the way yeah. as well. Well, just the opposite of what we have.
Aye. But it's also one of the things that was problematic in discussions right through the 60s and 70s, way back in the early days, was that people were saying, well, how do we deal with it? The problems of governance? And to me, the Norwegian model might help, because what I believe is that there should be an absolute right of recall, that whoever is the group that chose the representative can bring them back. An absolute right of recall. Because if you do that, that keeps the buggers on their toes. And I would also, I wouldn't let anybody serve more than two terms. Yeah. You know? Talking of which, just a wee bit of Scottish history. Charles Edward Stuart, in his last attempt on the British thrones, which was in 1759, an attempted invasion with a French fleet, had been sending ahead what was effectively a manifesto. And what he was suggesting was, by this point he'd left the Catholic Church and become Church of England, by the way, he was suggesting absolute religious tolerance, an end to the corruption in Parliament, and strangely, annual parliaments, which was what Tom Paine was pushing for just a few years later. When you go and you look at our history, there's really, really weird stuff comes out. That Charles Edward Stuart, that we all just thought was that drunken French numpty, was actually an Enlightenment figure. Just a shame he didn't care tuppence about Scotland. You know?
Surprised, but thanks very much, everyone, for your contributions, and thanks again to Stuart for joining us this evening and giving us that great talk.
Thank you. Very nice on my way.
Now, Ian has a few announcements to make, and then there's going to be an opportunity for some book buying, which is always an exciting moment in any evening.